And joining us right now on PMP Network is an icon. He is a guy that you know from Come On Down, the television automotive ads. But you know something? He is much more than automotive because his deep down inside his heart, he lives music. And Ernie Bach Jr. has written a couple books. The first one was called Bach Rock Facts. And if you read the Boston Herald, he does a column that kind of does that on a regular basis. But his new book is called Bach's Rock, and it's called Timeline. And it was written with Andy Valerio, and it's a really cool book with a timeline of music and rock and roll. And it goes back a long, long way because he traces the roots to back to 1526. So if you think to yourself, wow, that's kind of weird. Well, the book is really fascinating, and it also it gives you a lot of memories and a lot of thought. So, Ernie, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Mark.
And it's all part of the Music Drives Us campaign as well, right?
Right. Both books, all the proceeds go to Music Drives Us. It's my foundation that helps keep music in the schools, which does music therapy. It does a lot of things. You can check it out at musicdrivesus.org. And it's a great, great thing. The school system now, with the cutbacks, it's horrible. So trying to do my part to keep music as a necessity in schools.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I know that in Stoughton, we have an award-winning music department here. And the kids that could graduate from that program are all the top students in the school.
Right. Many, many studies have proven that when you take music younger, it makes you more communicative, less violent, better math skills. It's fantastic.
So what drove you to put Timeline out?
Well, I had the first book, which was kind of little stories of pop culture and music. And as I do that, and I still write those, and as I look, it's everything is so connected. Music is just so connected. An example now that I give is country music now is more popular than it's ever been. Country music is giant all over the country. And country music, you know, a lot of people say, oh, that's not fair. But I got to say, country music is like 70s rock right now, except they throw in a violin and a few twangy notes and they keep it country. But if you listen to it, it's like 70s rock. Personally, I love it. I think it's fantastic. As of this second, all the great guitar playing right now is in country.
Well, I kind of agree with you. In fact, one of my favorite bands is Lady Antebellum, and I compared some of the sounds of some of these groups to like the Eagles in the 70s.
Absolutely. And it can go back to Aerosmith and Boston, and if you listen and hear, everybody borrows from everybody. So I thought it would just be interesting to put some actual timeline to things that happened that influenced everything. You know, I mean, you got to say that the early rock and roll piano playing, you know, started in the, you know, when the piano was invented in the 1500s. I mean, it's, you know, you could actually follow it right down.
Now, before we get into the details of the book, we had a couple of people that emailed me questions for you, so I thought I'd ask them because there were some interesting questions that were sent in.
Sure.
Someone named Greg Wilberg asked, what do you think of Daddy's junky music going under and the circumstances that surrounded it? I asked because I jammed with you several times in practice area of the Dedham store.
Yeah, it was kind of a travesty what happened. Fred, great guy that owned it. I know his daughter Candy very well. The business got away from him. That's basically what happened. The business got away from him. And there was a little bit of a debt problem. One thing led to another. He got foreclosed on. And now it's gone.
It's a shame. Things like that can't be replaced.
Right.
Now, Sue from Florida writes, are there any current acts that you see lasting the test of time?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of bands around that do it. And if the band itself won't last, you know, the players will. A good example is Guns N' Roses. Guns N' Roses is still actually the holy grail for people that put bands back together. Guns N' Roses would be it. I mean, that would, rumor has it that they've been offered $600 to $800 million to do a year tour. So, but you know, I don't think it'll ever happen. But what came out of that is Slash. Slash is one of the last guitar rock stars, you know, so he'll be around for a while. He will stand the test of time. Maybe his band won't, but he himself will.
I find it amazing that the Rolling Stones are still out there.
I love it. I love that the Rolling Stones are still out there. I think it's fantastic. And look at Aerosmith. I mean,
yep,
their last record, did very well. They're playing all over the place. There's Red Hot Chili Peppers. Red Hot Chili Peppers, I think their first recordings were in the 70s.
Hmm. You know, a couple of things that you brought up in the book brought memories to me. As someone who's, we're about the same age, you and I.
Yeah.
And I remember watching the Ed Sullivan Show and seeing the Beatles and seeing Elvis Presley and stuff. And that kind of thing was something that, like for a while, Johnny Carson was like that too. If you were on a show like that, you were a huge sensation. You talk about the Ed Sullivan Show in the book.
Sure. I tell you, I don't remember the Beatles the actual night of the Beatles. I remember all the different, fallout from it when they were on, but actually seeing it, I didn't see it when I was a kid. But what I did see is a band was going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show, and my grandmother was babysitting me at the time. And we were all excited. What night was that on?
Sunday nights.
Yes, Sunday night. And that afternoon, I said, the Animals are going to be on Ed Sullivan. This is going to be great. The Animals are going to be on. And my grandmother goes, okay, we'll watch it. And when they introduced the Animals, and a rock group came on, my grandmother was like, she almost shut the TV off. She thought it was going to be like roller skating bears or something, you know.
One of my thrills was interviewing Eric Burdon. I love the band. Great band.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because when I look through your book, all these acts that you have in here, I mean, from Freddie Cannon and Dylan and, all of these people are all people that I've had a chance to either interview or talk to about different things. And I always think, and maybe it's just me, maybe it's just my age, but I always think that the best music was the mid-60s to early 70s. Would you agree on that, or do you think that it was good all along?
I think it's your age, because, I'm basically, I love that stuff, don't get me wrong, but if I had to freeze something in time, I'd say very late 60s to mid-70s, before the disco thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Before the disco thing, I love that stuff. Don't get me wrong, but then again, you gotta have a respect for the '80s, the '80s hair bands, Poison, and all those guys. They had a spot. They had a little niche that people really, really tugged on them. Are you familiar with the band Steel Panther?
No.
Steel Panther is a band coming up. They're on their way up right now. They're selling out all over Australia, Europe, England. They started as a goof, an '80s hair band. They wear wigs and everything, and they play original songs that sound like '80s hits. But they're coming on real, real strong. And if you haven't heard them, you will hear about them soon, because they're going to start to break in the United States. But that '80s hair band thing has a fiercely loyal following.
I can't compare that with the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Simon and Garfunkel, the Love and Spoonful, the music from that period was so rich and so vast that when you look at the top 40 lists, and I remember listening to WBZ and WRKO, who were the top 40 stations, and I even have collections of some of their charts. There was so many great bands. You can go from the Electric Prunes to these far out bands that were amazing. The Fugs, who had a big hit, by the way, called River of Shit. I don't know if you remember that song.
No,
the Fugs, River of Shit. Yeah, very good song.
Back then, you know, the top 40 was the you know, had big ears. You'd have Dean Martin and the Beatles on the same chart.
Mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra too.
And Frank Sinatra. Yep. So it was before the categorizations and the laser pointing of where you should be. Music was very, very open back then.
You talk in the book about G, the song by the Crows, which really, and I think you're correct on this, was really the start of the doo-wop era.
Right.
How important was the doo-wop in terms of development of rock and roll?
Well, I think it was a milestone. It was something that had to happen for it to go forward. If you recall, Oldies, I think they call it the Amp now in Boston. We had a station called the Oldies, Oldies 103.3. If you remember, what was it, 10 years ago they were playing doo-wop?
Mm-hmm, they were.
Something like that? Yep. You know, they were playing it, and sure, it's just one of those leapfrog moments where it had to happen in order for music to go. Personally, I am not a giant fan of doo-wop. I like doo-wop, I respect doo-wop, but I'm not a giant fan of it. But it definitely had to happen for rock and roll to continue.
I had the same feelings as you about doo-wop, and I had the honor of interviewing some of the members, the original members of the Coasters and the Drifters and some of these bands, and I feel so bad at what happened to them. Many of their names were bought by, like, lawyers in New York who were putting out people all over the place. I thought it was just a disgusting development that took place in terms of that kind of stuff.
Well, that whole era, and to some extent it happens today, not as much. But, you know, the big companies took all the contracts, were so one-sided, actually against the artist. But, you know, you had these extremely talented people without any business sense getting into these contracts and being, you know, being taken advantage of. So, you know, it happened, but hopefully it won't anymore.
Okay, one of the great illustrations of that was, I remember talking to Tommy James, who I've had on my show quite a few times. Not only did he get ripped off in his contract, but it was owned by the mob, and he had no way out.
Oh yeah, back then. I mean, and you know, look at the Aerosmith early contracts. They're horrible.
Mm. You know, when I had the honor of seeing Ernie on the Automatics, and in fact, have had the members of the band except you on the TV show, I love the music, and it's great that you brought back some of those guys from Boston.
Yeah, well, thank you. We had a good run. We played for about 6 years. You know, toured the country, toured Canada, opened up for all our heroes. Tried to open up. We were supposed to open up for Bo Diddley 3 weeks before he died. Unfortunately, we couldn't. But we opened up for so many people and played with so many legendary players that it was a lot of fun. And then last year, we went on the road. We toured North America and the United States with Deep Purple, played all the great theaters, played two nights at the Beacon, played at the Wang Center here, played at the Fox Theater, played at the Greek in L.A. And, you know, it was fun, but, man, that is not easy. At that level, at an opening band level, It's a tough grind. You got to get to the venue 4 to 5 hours early. You got to eat the backstage food. At the level we were, the accommodations weren't the greatest. It's just not, especially, I'm 54 years old, especially, you know, at this time of life, it's extremely difficult to do. So when we got off the road, we kind of just decided, let's just take a little break and see what we want to do. And, you know, everybody had their projects going, so, you know, we're kind of at that. Barry and Sid put together a really great band that plays Boston tunes, you know, and they're going to be going out. I'm trying to actually get them out with Steel Panther. And Brian Mays has his band cooking, and Tunes is still playing with John Cafferty and Brian occasionally with Barry. So everybody's still playing. It's just we just haven't really been playing together.
Now, how much of this book research did you do? I know that Andy helped you as well, because there's a ton of work in this book.
It is, but the thing about this book and the last book is, if you kind of live and breathe music. I got a little bit of a cold, excuse me. Live and breathe music. A lot of this stuff is kind of just rattling in your brain all the time. You know, you just kind of know. And then as you go to research, it all falls into place. But the great thing about this, and this is really the biggest project I've ever done with YouTube alive and well, is in this book, we name examples, and you can go to YouTube and actually see what we're talking about. So, and it's referenced a bunch of times in the book. So,
like in the course of G by the Crows, which you talked about.
Right.
Yeah.
You can go on and you can go see these old blues guys and doo-wop people and old rock stuff, and you can. I mean, we're not experts. You know, I'm not an expert on this stuff. A lot of this is opinion, and I made it perfectly clear in the book that it is just opinion. But you can see how it all is all from the same cloth. It's all one giant piece of fabric. It's rock and roll.
It's I love this book. I think it's a lot of fun, and I think people are going to really enjoy getting into it. And one of the things you wrote about, and I find it fascinating, because the first album I ever bought, first one, with my own money, I bought two albums at Leechmere Sales. One of them was the theme from Batman.
Yeah.
And the other one was the Monkees' first album.
Yeah. Sure.
And you talk about the Monkees here, and you said you couldn't believe how they actually competed with the Beatles at that time.
They were the American Beatles. I mean, they were up there with the charts with the Beatles. Of course, they didn't have the staying power and blah, blah, blah. But at the time, there was no bigger band when they were hot. I had the pleasure of playing with Peter Tork from the Monkees,
mm-hmm.
which was very, very a big giant thrill. We played at Foxwoods and we were his backup band, and when he came into the dressing room, we're like, hey, you know, Peter, you know, what do you want to play? And he pulled out his guitar, and we were in a little circle, and he was going over the chords, going, okay, we'll do this at this and this at this, and me and Barry looked at each other, we're going, oh man, I can't believe we're in the same circle. Peter's calling out chords to us, you know, which it was incredible.
Yeah, now I had the thrill of interviewing him and Mickey and Davey as well on the radio. The only one that wouldn't do it was Mike Nesmith. But I had to admit this, but I loved the Monkees' music. I thought, you know, some of the stuff that they had, like Sometime in the Morning, which was written by Carole King, and I'm a Believer, which was written by Neil Diamond. I actually enjoyed their music. It wasn't really their music.
They were part of the machine. They at the beginning, the first couple records, that music was written, done, recorded by all the great studio musicians, all the great writers, Don Krishna at the head, and they just brought the Monkees in to sing. And it was a perfect formula.
And the show was, you know, I used to really love watching the show, and it reminded me of A Hard Day's Night or Help. It was really imitating the Beatles films.
Sure, and there's, you know, at the beginning, the first, what was it, three seasons, I think it went. The first season was completely, you know, they weren't stoned or anything like that, you can tell. But as the series progressed, and one of the ways you can tell is when Mickey Dolan's hair became curly, when they stopped straightening it,
mm-hmm.
you can just, if you watch it nowadays, you can tell they're all stoned. You can tell that they're all smoking pot, and their eyes are like slits. I mean, it's pretty funny.
It is. I actually have I'm sure you must have the DVD collections as well.
Sure.
Now, there's a couple things in the book that I thought were really, there's so many fascinating things in there I want to get into. You talked about the importance of slavery, of the people, the slaves that came into this country, their role in the music.
Of course. I mean, that's it. See, for me, that's like common knowledge. You know, that's something that be, you know, being into music, you just kind of know. If people aren't familiar with it, was the call and response and the picking of the cotton that the American music started, the blues music started. That's where it all began. And then after, you know, when they were done, they'd be in the in the little shacks, and they'd whip out the guitar, and it would all start to form. I mean, the actual 12-bar blues, at the beginning, blues was 9 bars, 15 bars, 16 bars. There wasn't a consistent, if you listen to the recordings of the 20s, 30s, and even the 40s, when they're doing these blues progressions, which you would think would be a standard 12-bar blues, they'd throw 13 bars, 14 bars in, and it really didn't become completely established until the mid-40s, the 12-bar blues.
Hmm. Another thing you mentioned, and you should because you graduated from there, but Berklee School of Music, it's amazing how many people have come out of there and how many Grammy Awards and nominations have come out of there as well.
Oh, it's crazy. Right now, the people on the board of Berklee, right as of right now, the current board, I think there's 18 Grammys amongst the people in the board.
Well, you're on the board as well, right?
I was on the board for almost 6-7... About say 8 years, a little under 8 years. Yeah, it was incredible. It was unbelievable. The school is amazing. The new president is fantastic, and they've got board members like Paul Simon, Christopher Guest. They've got some really, really great people steering that ship.
One of the things in the book that I think stands out, and it's important to me, too, because I think that it was a really big part of the establishment of rock and roll, was the folk era. Peter Palmieri and Barry McGuire and the early
Absolutely.
Dylan and things like that. Yeah. You talk quite a bit about that.
There's a great book called The Mansion on the Hill. I forget who wrote it, but it's about pretty much that era when these hippies or beatniks, whatever you want to call them, all of a sudden, the collision of that culture and money. You know, the Neil Youngs of the world, Neil Young is up in Canada in the late 60s, you know, just playing his guitar, and he comes down in the early 70s, and all of a sudden, boom, he's making all this crazy money. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, all those people, all that type of stuff. It's called The Mansion on the Hill. I highly recommend it. There were two hot spots during that era, and it was San Francisco and Boston. And it talks all about it. It's very good. The people in the book are still around Boston today, and you can relate to it.
And one of the incidents in Boston that you talk about in your book happened in May 1958, when Alan Freed came in here at Boston Arena. And all hell broke loose from that.
Yeah. It's back in the days. It's funny. A lot of times, the Rolling Stones and their first shows ended in riots. I mean, they almost never finished a show. They ended in riots. People just going crazy.
What, Altamont, there was deaths involved.
Yeah, it was a whole different thing. That was a completely different thing. Yeah. Was very, very sad.
The Hells Angels involved in that one.
Yes.
Yeah. There's some amazing stuff in this book, folks, and it's called Bach's Rock and the Timeline, and it's available at musicdrivesus.org, right?
Yeah, musicdrivesus.org and any Newbery Comics.
Newbery Comics has it, but, you know, if you go to musicdrivesus.org, you can get an autographed copy.
Yeah.
$25.
For a little bit more, you get an autographed copy, and again, all proceeds go to musicdrivesus.org. Please check out musicdrivesus.org and see what we're doing to help keep music in the schools.
I know it's a hard question to answer, Ernie, because people ask me all the time. But out of all the bands that you've seen and heard and bought records of, who ranks as your top couple of bands?
Well, sure. I mean, but I'm a real traditional guy. You know what I mean? I'm a real you know, rock and roll type of guy. You know, I have, you know, the Led Zeppelin and Jeff Beck and that type of stuff. And then I like the earlier country blues stuff with Mississippi John Hurt and all those Robert Johnson and all that stuff. The stuff that Eric Clapton, when the English looked back at the African American blues artists of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they took all that, regurgitated it, added Les Pauls and Marshall amps to it, and regurgitated it back to the United States, and the United States embraced it. It's kind of crazy because the United States had it, and it took the English to reintroduce it to us. But that's really what I like. I like the blues-based rock and roll. That's personally my favorite.
Well, I'll tell you something. The memories are all here, folks, and if you want to check it, pretty much everything you'll ever remember from rock and roll, it's all in this book, and stuff that you won't remember as well. Again, you might want to get it. And if you need a car, check out the Bach dealerships. And Ernie Bach Jr. has the best parties of anybody I've ever attended, so I want to say that as well.
Excellent.
Yeah. And thanks so much for coming on the program. And again, musicdrivesus.org is where you can find the book, as well as Newbery Comics. We'll talk to you soon, Ernie. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.